Well, good morning, everyone. Is anyone there? Good morning. This morning we're going to take a little bit of a break from our series on Jeremiah, because it's that time of year again. Tuesday is Shrove Tuesday, the day when traditionally you're supposed to use up all of the food in your cupboards to start a 40-day fast, but which in reality, at least in our house anyway, is an excuse to eat sweet things for dinner. But I've got a bit of a confession to make, probably not one that will fill you with confidence in a sermon entitled Preparing for Lent, but I'm actually not the biggest fan of Lent. Not because I've got strong theological objections to it, but because I'm not convinced by the way in which it's often practiced today. I'm all for setting time aside for God, or set time to focus on Jesus, to practice spiritual disciplines, and to prepare for Easter. But we must be careful when we practice Lent that we don't fall into some traps. There are three traps that I think that we can... How good do those pancakes look, by the way? And three dangers that we can fall into. Firstly, we can trivialize Lent. As I said, Lent was traditionally a 40-day fast. And the idea of Lent was that you would identify with Jesus when he was tempted in the desert. And he fasted from food for 40 days. And the idea would be that if you were able to identify with him then it would help you to prepare to identify with him at the cross at Easter. Of course, today we don't tend to fast all food for 40 days at Lent. We often just fast from one item of food, which is often chocolate. Now, it is possible that you might be able to identify with Christ by fasting from chocolate, but at least for me, I don't think that would help me very much at all. So we need to be careful we don't trivialize Lent. And secondly, we need to make sure we don't make Lent about me. I would suggest that by far the most common thing that can happen when we give up an item of food for a period of time is that our focus shifts quite quickly from Christ, who it's all about, to focusing on ourselves, on our ability to abstain from something for 40 days. Now, having a strong willpower is not a bad thing. It's a very good thing. But it's not the focus of Lent. We're missing the point. We're missing the point, actually, of Easter if we make things about ourselves. Because Jesus coming to this earth, now it was for us, but it's not about us. It's about God and about him demonstrating his love to us. So when Lent becomes about us, it ceases to be Lent because it doesn't prepare us for Easter. So we need to make sure we don't make Lent about ourselves. And then thirdly, I think making Lent temporary. Instead of giving up things, a recent trend has been to take up things instead. Maybe we endeavor to read our Bible more, or pray more, or fast more. But the temptation comes when those 40 days are over to just slip back into the same routine that we had before. Now, it was good to pursue those things for those 40 days. But had we kept them up, Lent would have been an even more valuable time for us. But don't hear me wrong this morning. I'm not the Lent Scrooge. What I'm actually proposing is that not that we abandon Lent, but that we take it a bit more seriously. Later, I'm going to introduce us, or at least those of us who haven't heard of it, to a Lent challenge called 40 Acts. I know some people in the church have done it before. But in the introductory material It asks this question: what if Lent was to become a preparation for a lifetime of big-heartedness? What if Lent was to become a preparation for a lifetime of big-heartedness? The aim of the challenge is to produce lasting impact in our lives. As we ponder how to take Lent more seriously, then, let's think about what God actually asks from us as Christians. Familiar verses, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Now, these verses are incredibly familiar to a lot of us, and it's easy to skip over them, to not see exactly what God was saying to the Romans, what God is saying to us through them. These are absolutely pivotal verses in the book of Romans. The point where Paul shifts from explanation to application. And God's saying something incredibly radical, something life-altering, not just for Lent, but for our whole lives. So I want us this morning to maybe digest this a little bit slower than we normally would our passages. So let's start with the first word, with therefore. Now this, of course, as you know, is a link word. It connects two statements or two thoughts together. So for example, if I was eating that big stack of pancakes that we saw at the start, I might say to you, when you looked at me, I might say, I was hungry, therefore I'm eating some pancakes. The same is true. Paul's connecting what he spent 11 chapters outlining God's incredible gospel, his amazing mission that has Jesus' death and resurrection at its focal point. He's connecting with this, with what he's about to say. God's mission, the gospel, has implications. There are actions required, a response that must be made. So he said, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters. Now this word that we have translated urge, it's stronger than a suggestion. It's an exhortation. It's something that he is compelled to tell him. This is the only adequate response to this incredible gospel that has just been wonderfully explained. It's an appeal. It's like if you ever watch Red News Day, Comic Relief. They have these celebrities that travel to the incredibly impoverished places in the world, and they show you what the money raised will go to help. And at the end, there's that appeal. There's the in view of this, give us your money. That's the sort of appeal that Paul is making. He's saying, in view of this, do this. And he says it again, in view of God's mercy. He's just repeating, this serves exactly the same purpose as the therefore. I urge you, I appeal to you to do this because of God's mercy. Now what exactly is he asking of them? He's asking them to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. First, this word offer is used five times in chapter 6. That's the only time that Paul makes any sort of appeal in the first 11 chapters. And the point that he's making back in chapter 6 is that when someone becomes united with Christ, they die to their sin, they're freed from its power, and are therefore free to choose to live a different way. Now that's really important for what we're considering here. What Paul is saying here, to offer your lives as a living sacrifice, can only be followed when freedom to choose that life is realized. This is only a response that can be given by someone who has experienced the mercy of God, who's been cleansed from their sin, who's been freed from its power. They are to offer. And bodies here, that's more than just physical. We relate to the world, don't we, through our bodies. We think with our minds. We touch with our hands. We move with our limbs. We speak with our mouths. We act, don't we, using our bodies. And it makes sense then that the Greek word would be all-encompassing. Paul is saying that the Romans, that we are to offer our entire selves to God. And we are to do so as living sacrifices. Now, that phrase is quite curious, isn't it? Sacrifice was, of course, an Old Testament practice, one which involved killing animals or burning grain. Sacrifice involved death. But here, the sacrifice is to be living. Now, how do we do that? How do we present our lives as a living sacrifice? Last year at Keswick, one of my brother's friends was telling us about an experience that he had while he was in the Salt Mine Band. The Salt Mine Band was a Christian band that traveled around the country, and whenever they went to places, they would play gigs in churches or in village halls and stuff like that. And they tended to stay with families from the church who'd invited them to come. And my brother's friend, this one time, he hit the absolute jackpot with where he was to stay that night. He arrived at the house, and he knew it was big because they told him he could stay in the east wing. But it was what happened the next day that really took the biscuit. The lawyer offered him a lift to church, so he agreed and said, "Oh, I'll just go and get my stuff." So off he went to get his stuff, and he opened the front door, and he was met with this sight. This was at the time, not now, but it was at the time, a brand new Porsche 911 Turbo. And somehow my brother's friend managed to get his guitar into this thing. I don't really know where he put it, but he got it in. And just as he was about to get into the passenger seat, the lawyer looked at him and said, "So have you ever driven a car like this before?" And of course his answer was no. So he chucked him the keys and he said, "Don't worry." This is brand new, like 6 weeks old. He chucked in the keys, said, "Don't worry, you're covered on my insurance." And so he drives down the road to the church in this car, and at the perfect moment, because as he arrives at church, all the other band members are getting out of their cars and standing outside the church. And he winds down his window, or I think it was probably a wind down still at that point, and shouts out his window, "Hey guys, this salt mine thing doesn't pay too badly, does it?" See, presenting our bodies as living sacrifices means throwing Jesus the keys to our most precious possession, our lives, letting him get in the driving seat. Because doing this is holy and pleasing to God. This is the only way to live lives that are pleasing to God. It's the only way to live lives, because the only way to be set apart for God is to be set apart by God. And this is your true and proper worship. Not only is it the only way to live for God, it's the only way to worship God properly, honestly. So that's what God is saying we need to do. It's radical, isn't it? He's saying, give me your whole life. But how do we do that? Well, verse 2 helps us. And verse 2 starts with a negative appeal. He says, "Do not be conformed Do not conform to the pattern of this world. One of my favorite animals is this chap here. This is a cuttlefish. Now, they're really interesting because when they hunt, what they do is they change color rapidly to mesmerize their prey, and then they strike. But they can also do what a chameleon can do. They can change their color in order to blend in to their surroundings. It's a defense mechanism. Now, this word for conform that we have in Greek is that sort of change. It's very much an outward change. To conform is to look like something. So Paul is telling us, he's telling the Romans, do not be like cuttlefish. Fight that very human urge we all have to blend in, to behave the way everyone else behaves. And he goes on, he says, don't be conformed, but be transformed. Now that's a very different word for conform. It's the same word that's used to describe Jesus' altered state on the mountain of transfiguration. There we see a glimpse of what the new body in future glory will look like. And if you were to read through Romans, throughout the book, Paul has this negative view of self. He recognizes its sinfulness, its weakness, its need for transformation, but he also recognizes that this transformation is not something that we can do on our own. He says it happens by the renewing of your mind. Literally, it happens as your mind is made new. Paul helps us elsewhere to understand how that happens. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18, and says, and we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. So Paul is saying here that it's by the Spirit that we are being transformed, but also that we have a responsibility. Our responsibility is there. Those with unveiled faces are to contemplate the Lord's glory. They are to gaze upon Jesus. They are to behold him. To take Jesus in. The Spirit transforms our minds to be like Jesus' mind as we fill our minds with him. Back to Romans, he continues. He says, then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. A transformed mind leads to a transformed life. It filters out into our speech, into our action, and we begin to increasingly function within the will of God. Now, the rest of Romans basically expands on this point. It shows us what a life lived in response to the gospel looked like. It shows us what a life looks like when the mind of a person has been transformed to look like Jesus. And he basically says two things. Firstly, love one another, even those who hate you. And secondly, he says, welcome one another in the way in which you have been welcomed by Christ. This is what the gospel is supposed to do. God's love has been displayed to us in the most incredible sacrifice. Jesus coming from heaven to earth to be a man, to be despised and rejected and hated by those he came to save, and then to die on a cross and be mocked as he bears the weight of the sin of the world upon his shoulders. And he rises again, defeating death and sin and the evil one forever. Ought that not to provoke a response in our lives? You see, knowing the gospel is the source of our conviction to be transformed. To fill our minds, though, is the role that we have to play in the transformation process. So before we think about the implications for Lent of this passage, let's just to consider two broader questions for us as people. Firstly, Who is in the driving seat of my life? Maybe you're one of those backseat drivers. You're telling Jesus what you think he should be doing, where you think he should be going. Maybe you haven't ever even chucked in the keys. This morning, can I encourage you, can I urge you, as Paul did, to do something about that this morning, to pray, to ask for forgiveness, to pass the keys if you need to do that, and to let Jesus take control of your life. And then secondly, am I filling my mind with Christ? Do I devour God's word in search for Jesus? Do I learn about him through preaching, through singing, through reading Christian books, through talking to other Christians about him? Am I filling my mind with him? So with this in mind, I think Lent provides us with several fantastic opportunities. Lent gives us the opportunity to refocus our lives. As you know, as a church, we've been repeatedly challenged about change, about giving our whole hearts to God. If you haven't done that yet, if you haven't given all the keys over, if you like, or if you feel like you're trying to pinch the keys back, Lent provides you an excellent opportunity to work towards Easter, to press on to give our whole for God. And secondly, could there be any better way actually to prepare for Easter than by filling our minds with Christ? Will Easter not be even more incredible if for 40 days we put him and all that he has accomplished at the forefront of our minds? And thirdly, if we fill our minds with Christ, then we will avoid those first two traps we talked about, trivializing Lent, making it about ourselves. But I think particularly as a church, as you know, we need to be careful about activity, because we love doing things, but often we can do things at the detriment of filling our minds with Christ. The minute we take our eyes off Jesus, the minute that our activity becomes self-seeking, it's the minute potentially that it can stop altogether. So we must keep Jesus at the forefront of our minds when we seek to be proactive in our transformation. Now, 40 Acts is a challenge for Lent that seeks to help us have bigger hearts, seeks to help us be more generous with our time, with our money, with our lives. And generosity really ought to be one of those distinctive characteristics that we have in a gospel-shaped life, because the generosity that God has shown us in Jesus is astonishing. God gives his son. Jesus gives his life that we might have life and have it in abundance. So in light of God's generosity, we should be generous, opening our hearts as wide as possible. And it's a very simple thing. This is how it works. You sign up here. This is the website. So if you type in 40 Acts, you'll be met with this. If you scroll down, you'll see this chap, and underneath him, there is a sign up there with the orange box beside it. You just sign your name and your email address, and then every day they'll send you a challenge. I think there's like three options usually, depending on how much time you've got. There's a green, which is reasonably easy to do, an orange, which is a bit more time consuming, and then a red, which is even more time consuming than that. And you just kind of pick depending on how much time you've got each day. And it's a great way to involve your kids as well in doing something at Lent. And the idea is that you do this for 40 days, and then by the end of it, it'll help you become more generous. But as we said, that only works as we fill our minds with Christ. So we'd love to challenge you to do this, to take part in this over Lent, because we hope and pray that it will be a time of growth for you in this area, but also Because we're excited by the sort of impact that it can have, not just across our city, but with over 100,000 Christians doing it around the country. That's got to have an impact on our country. So in a moment, we're going to sing, we're going to pray. But before we do that, I wanted us just to watch a little video. This is the video of a lady called Lindy, who took part in the challenge last year. And this is how it has impacted upon her life.
I'd never gone out of my way to help a stranger before. I was walking home with my daughter in her pushchair, and I came across a lady who was really struggling to push a bike that had got a flat tyre. But the lady also had a crutch, and she was really, really, really struggling. And so I stopped and said, "Can I help you?" "No, no, I'm fine," she said. Sort of being very British, normally I would go, "Okay, yeah, that's fine," and go off. But I think because I was doing 40 acts, I was almost determined to give it another chance. She was trying to get to Halfords to get the tyre changed because it's her son's bike and he needed it to get to work because it's his only form of transport. So I said, "Oh, I'll go and get my car," and she sort of accepted it. So I rushed up home, got my daughter in the car, drove to find her. She'd sort of struggled down the road about 10 metres. She said she didn't even believe I was going to come back for her. And it turned out that she'd actually recently come out of a women's refuge with her two children. And so she'd had a really, really tough time. And, you know, I'd have really loved to kind of, looking back, I'd have loved to sort of talk to her a bit more about Jesus. I didn't do any of those things. I just kind of made excuses. "Oh, I'm not normally this nice, but I'm doing this thing called 40 Acts." And just said, you know, just try and do something kind for somebody every day. We got to Halfords, she got out of the car, and I kind of sat there and felt very strange, really, as I was reflecting on it, because I've never really gone out of my way to help a stranger before. And she came out of the shop and she said, "Oh, it's going to be 10 or 15 minutes, so you just go." And I was like, no, it's fine, I've got nothing to do, I'll drop you home." And she said to me, "Nobody's ever done anything like this for me before." And as I sat in the car, just my daughter in the back, just reflecting while she was in the shop, I thought that was just crazy. Like, it cost me so little. It was like half an hour of my time and a couple of pounds in petrol. And yet to her, it was such a big thing. I don't know if I'd have come across her any other way. I don't know if I'd have started chatting to a woman who's sort of recently come out of a refuge. I don't know if I'd have been in that position had it not been for kind of being determined to do something nice today. I love 40 Acts, partly because I don't have to give up things that I like, like chocolate and things, but it's really nice how inventive you can be with being generous. Some of the things are so easy, but some of them are quite out of my comfort zone, and it's lovely to be able to try different things and challenge myself in different ways. You know, I love God's extravagance in his generosity, and I think, you know, I think I probably used to be a bit tight, and I think, you know, stepping out little ways and being generous, it's actually a really lovely journey.
Could you just click the PowerPoint up again, Phil? So that's how it kind of impacted upon her life. Of course, you don't have to do 40 acts, but we'd really encourage you to do it and give it a go this Lent. See what sort of opportunities God might put in your path, like he did for Lindy. I'm just going to put up those, flick back to those questions. Oh, I've gone the wrong way. Yeah. And I'll just give you a couple of minutes to think through those and think about 40 acts as well. Maybe pray and ask God, "Is this something that I could do, or that we could do as a family over the next few days, or next 40 days?" And in a moment, Davina will come and lead us in a final song, and then I'll close in prayer.